मनोबुद्ध्यहङ्काररचितानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वे न च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मेऽन्नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा चिदानन्दरूपा। Chidanand Roopa नचासंगतम नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानंद रूपा स्योऽहं स्योऽहं चिदानंद रूपा स्योऽहं स्योऽहं चिदानंद रूपा चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं 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 शिवोहं
Hello, good afternoon, good evening, good morning for those of you who are in parts of the world where it's morning, very early morning for some of you, and welcome to our fifth class in the Shiva Sutras. We're about to plunge into book two, the part of this particular array of teachings that focuses on Shakti as the mind. We've been looking at the awareness aspect of consciousness, the path to self-realization through meditating on awareness, which is sometimes called the direct path. We're about to look at the path to God through recognizing the true nature of the mind. And next week, we'll talk a little bit about the path of the individual, which is very often, which is, of course, where most of us begin because we are individuals. So, and in the last class, and hopefully in your practice this week, you tuned into the heart space, the subtle expansive energy that begins to invite us when we focus on breathing into and through the center in the chest, the center behind the breastbone. But the point of it, the purpose of it, or let's say the underlying philosophical teaching that we approached last week was a recognition that the heart center, the Anahata Chakra, or the inner Hridai, is one of the most immediate and accessible doorways to the great heart, to the center of consciousness that in Shaivism is called a Hridai, and which is another name for God. And, you know, the heart in Shaivism, again, as we said last week, the heart in Tantra refers to a very high, perhaps, the tradition says, the highest, the most exalted, the most advanced awareness that we can aspire to or that we can experience, which is the recognition that this entire universe, both the transcendent non-duality where we're experiencing ourselves as pure consciousness, and the immanent reality, that is this mundane world where everything seems separate and different, in other words, the world of duality, that both of these aspects of reality, absolute non-duality and duality itself, are all contained in the heart. So part of what the tantras tell us and what the commentators on the Shiva Sutras tell us, it's actually quite crucially important, is that tantra does not privilege the transcendent. In other words, Tantra doesn't say that the transcendent non-dual, where everything dissolves into pure consciousness, pure awareness. The Tantras don't say that this is the highest reality. The Tantras say that the highest reality is the heart, where Shiva, the transcendent light, and Shakti, the dynamism that manifests forms, live in complete union and complete blissful erotic connection, and that in this space of the heart, everything is contained. So in the heart, duality is as sacred as non-duality. And this is, of course, a profoundly important recognition because, for one thing, it helps us see that, you know, our life, our human life, with all its ups and downs and all its aspirations, is equally a part of the divine. It's not that what we want to do in this life is transcend our humanity and live in, you know, the spaciousness of pure awareness. For sure, we do want to experience that transcendence because it's first of all, a very exalted and blissful state, but also because it puts everything into a radical perspective. We do want to experience transcendence, but we also want to experience immanence and duality as just as intrinsically divine as the transcendent reality. And that's our goal, and that's what we are aiming at when we meditate on the Great Heart, where the Shaivite sages consider it us to be connected to this ultimate fusion of duality and non-duality, to the juicy, love-saturated rasa, the primal experience of Shiva Shakti holding within themselves the physical and emotional world. And I want to say that the heart center, which is one of the great portals to the Great Heart, and I like to approach it by opening the back so that I'm also experiencing the space behind the body, which for me is an even more open portal to the Great Heart than the space behind the breastbone inside the body. But this is not the only, it's not the only way to enter the Great Heart. We can also enter it by meditating on the central channel, the vertical pathway that runs up the inner body from the base to the crown, parallel to the spinal column that connects the chakras. We can enter it by focusing on the space 8 finger widths above the crown, known as the Dwadashanta or the Sahasrara. We can enter it by focusing on the Ajna Chakra, the space in the center of the head, corresponding to the place between the eyebrows, but inside the head. Each of these spaces in the body are openings into the Great Heart, because the human body is designed in such a way that it's filled with portals into the infinite, doorways that lead us through our mundane experience of ourselves and into the heart of awareness. And because the heart is everywhere, just as awareness is everywhere, we can enter it through many doorways. And to answer the question that Vicki Loudon asked, just sent in on the listserv, another name for the Great Heart is the Madhya, which is a Sanskrit word. It's spelled M-A-D-H-Y-A. It literally means the center. And what the Madhya is the open spaciousness that exists at the beginning and the end of any human activity, which is, of course, mostly hidden by the activity itself, but which we can enter into by meditating on the space between the beginning of, between the end of the inhalation and the beginning of the exhalation, or on the space between one thought and another thought, and through many, on the space that arises just before we fall into sleep and just before we wake up. All of these spaces, these gaps, are also doorways into the Great Heart. And in the tantras, as in yoga generally, there are many, many names and many particular ways of describing the portals to the infinite, which can confuse us because they sound like different spaces. But actually, they are simply different names and different ways of entering into the one spacious presence that is the source of all of it. So last week, we meditated in the heart by following the breath with the Hamsa mantra, and we're going to be delving more into the lore of mantra during this week. But, Hamsa, as you know, means I am that. Hamsa, or I am Shakti, is actually the way I like to describe it, the way I like to translate it. And Hamsa is considered to be, this is This is a very important point that a lot of tantric sages make, and which my guru used to stress very strongly. Hamsa is considered to be a natural mantra. And Hamsa is actually the same mantra as Soham, which is another version of Hamsa. Soham is Hamsa with the syllables reversed. And in Sanskrit grammar, when you change the order of the syllables, the a in sa becomes the o in so. So Hamsa Soham, meaning my individual consciousness is not different from the vastness of the universe, is considered both in the tantric, Shaiva tantric traditions and also in the Advaita traditions to be a mantra that is not made up, that is not in any way artificial, because it is actually the sound that the breath makes when it comes in and out of the body. You can hear the breath as Hamsa, you can hear it as Soham, and I've practiced both versions of the mantra. You can also hear it as Soha, which is actually the secret mantra that was given as an initiation mantra in the Shaiva lineages. And as you can hear, they are essentially the same sounds, kind of given different meanings or articulated in different ways. A sound of Hamsa, essentially, is the inner speech encoded into our body that reminds us of our true identity. And what this means is that even when the conditioned mind is going, I'm Sally, or I'm Marilyn, or I'm tired, or I'm fabulous, or I'm confused, or I'm unworthy, the breath is always speaking the truth. The inhalation is saying hum, and the exhalation is saying sa. And, or perhaps the inhalation is saying so, and the exhalation is saying hum. But basically, what the breath is telling you is, I am that. I am awareness. I am Shakti. I am pure presence. Hamsa reminds you that your feeling of being yourself when stripped of identification with the body and the personal history is actually not different than God's sense of being a self, than Shakti's sense of being a self. You know, the great analogy in the tradition has to do with the water in a bucket and the water in the ocean. You know, when you take a bucket of water out of the Pacific Ocean, the water in the bucket is ocean water. In the same way, the individual feeling of I am, of being, is made of the same stuff as Shiva Shakti's feeling of I am, of being. It's just that because our I am-ness is conditioned to identify with the container, with the body, with the mind, with the personality, we feel limited. But fundamentally, we're not different. And in book one of the Shiva Sutras, where, as you remember, the first sutra is the self is consciousness, Chaitanyam Atma, our identity with the highest focuses on the identity of our knowing conscious awareness with the highest consciousness. In book two, where the first sutra is Chittam Mantraha, the mind is mantra, what is essentially being said is that your mind also, your mind, which, as we know, is normally filled with all sorts of thoughts and ideas, movements, ripples, old song titles, you know, old ideas, the mind itself is also identical with Shiva Shakti, expressed as the sacred understanding of mantric language, and we'll go into this in some detail later on. So in the last sutra of book one, sutra 22, Shiva reminds us that the simple feeling of being, the pure I am, is your connection to divinity. And in one of the commentaries on this sutra, it's also pointed out that our personal feeling of identity and our experience of a world as being different from ourselves is the work of a group of shaktis, of energies, known as the shakti chakras, or the wheels of energy, which actually are born within the great I amness, radiating out from the self, from the core of consciousness, just the way rays emanate from the sun, and then manifesting as all experience. So basically what we're looking at here, because although these sutras, you know, there are many of them, they're not arranged in a linear order. Someone wrote in to say that she feels that the sutras are somewhat scattered, and it's true, they're not linear. The Shiva Sutras is not a programmatic philosophical work. What it seems to be is a series of insights that arose from the core of consciousness and that are collected in these sutras and divided into the ones that point to pure awareness, the ones that point to the energy of mind and language, and the ones that point to all the different yogic practices, including asana, worship, ritual, offering, that people work with in the way to the truth. The underlying principle in the Shiva Sutras is the principle of non-duality. However we approach the truth, whatever, you know, categories, whatever lists, whatever numbers, because, you know, the yogic texts are very into lists and numbers, as you know, whatever particularities we may come up with on the journey, the deep truth is that all of it is contained in the one Shiva Shakti, and that one Shiva Shakti is dancing in every particle of the universe and in every particle of our mind. So, as Abhinavagupta says, consciousness is everything. There's nothing here which is not Shiva. And if we just hold that recognition and realize that all of these teachings, and this is the way I experience them, all of these teachings are here not for us to learn them like we learn, you know, the parts of the body in, you know, in our yogic anatomy class. They're here to turn our minds towards this truth, to occupy our minds in ruminating on the truth, in ruminating on these divine ideas. And as we ruminate on them, insight as to what a particular sutra means starts to arise, which is very cool. But more than that, and this is my experience, having spent the last 5 weeks reading this text with the intention of helping you understand it better, you know, because I have to explain it, that these last 5 weeks of meditating on the Shiva Sutras have been as profound and transformative for me as for any of you, because what's held in these sutras is not simply a vehicle for intellectually understanding the structure of reality, but also a path to connecting ourselves to the heart of reality. And in my experience, that's what the teachings of Tantra are really meant to do, not to make us scholars, not to make us well-versed in, you know, this particular language, but actually to transform our consciousness, to allow our mind and intellect, which, as you know, are normally focused on relatively mundane things, to allow our mind and intellect to remember the freedom of what they really are. Let's chant and meditate, and then we'll plunge into the sutra, Chittam Mantraha, the mind is mantra. So find a posture, a comfortable upright posture. Feel the connection between your sits bones and the seat. And as you connect to the seat, feel that you're connecting to the earth. Feel that you're grounding to the earth. One of the things I really like to do, especially when I'm studying something or meditating on something quite abstract, so to speak, quite subtle, as we are doing in this class, is to actually feel my feet on the ground. And you can do it if you're seated cross-legged. You can feel that your legs as well as your buttocks are touching the ground, connecting to the ground, and then imagining that from the core of the earth, earth energy, which I like to imagine as actual soil, you know, as very physical soil, not just as an earth-colored light, but as dirt. Feel that your legs and buttocks are filled with dirt, as though your lower body had been sunk into the earth, or, you know, as if you were on the beach and had buried your lower body in sand, as we sometimes like to do. So just feel yourself grounded in that earthy energy. And from that grounded base, feel the spinal column, which contains the Madhya Nadi, the central channel. Feel it, the spinal column rising up from the center of the pelvis all the way up through the crown. Let your shoulder blades release onto the back. Let your chest open. And we'll chant three times each the Ganesha mantras, the Mahamrityunjaya mantra, the Dakshinamurti shloka to the Guru, and the invocation to the primordial goddess. And then I'll give you some instructions and we'll meditate together. Let's begin as we sit in our grounded posture by feeling the presence of all these beings who are here with us, whether on today's call or tuning into us tomorrow or the next day or next week, because this Sangham remains alive for anyone who is part of it anytime you listen or tune in. So feel the presence of all of us. Imagine yourself lighting a candle, recognizing that the candle represents both the light of the self and also your aspiration. And imagine yourself placing the candle in the center of our subtle circle, where it becomes the witness to the Sangham. And we'll chant. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Vakratunda Mahakaya Koti Surya Samaprabha. Niravignam Kurume Deva Sarva Karyeshu Sarvada. Vakratunda Mahakaya Koti Surya Samaprabha. Nirvignam Kurume Deva Sarva Karyeshu Sarvada. Vakratunda Mahakaya Koti Surya Samaprabha. Nirvignam Kurume Deva Sarva Karyeshu Sarvada. And the Shiva mantras. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Om Trayambakam Yajamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Om. And the Dakshinamurti Shloka. Gurave Sarvalokanam Bisaje bhavaroginam nidhaye sarva vidyanam dakshinamurtaye namaha. Gurave sarvalokanam bisaje bhavaroginam nidhaye sarva vidyanam dakshinamurtaye namaha. Gurave sarva lokanam visaje bhavaroginam nidhaye sarva vidyanam dakshina murtaye namaha. And the invocation to the Devi, the primordial goddess. Sarva mangala mangalye Shive sarvatra sadike Sharanye trayambake gauri Narayane namostute. Sarva mangala mangalye Shive sarvatra sadike Sharanye trayambake gauri Narayane namostute. Sarva mangala mangalye Shive sarvatra sadike Sharanye trayambake gauri Narayane namostute. Om. Firming your posture if need be. Begin to allow your attention to flow with the breath, finding the subtle caress of the breath at the edge of the nostrils, following that energetic felt sense of the breath down through the nasal passages, through the throat, down to the diaphragm in the solar plexus, and into the heart. So you're inhaling into the space below the heart and then allowing the end of the inhalation to bring your awareness into the heart. And then with the exhalation, let the breath flow out. And I'm going to ask you to create a very tiny pause at the end of the inhalation before the exhalation arises. And focus your attention in that pause. And then as the exhalation flows outward, create an infinitesimal, like no more than 1 second or 2 seconds maximum, at the end of the exhalation, and focus your attention there. And as you begin to hear the breath flowing in with hum, flowing out with sa, begin to notice how the inhalation dissolves into that tiny pause in the heart and how the exhalation dissolves outside. Hear the sound of the breath, and you can even allow the breath to make a little noise. And notice how the breath, when the breath dissolves, it's possible to focus on this gap at the end of the inhalation and at the end of the exhalation. And once you've discovered the location of the gap, the location of this openness, opening, you can focus your attention there, either at the end of the inhalation or at the end of the exhalation. And allow the breath to arise and subside naturally. While your attention lingers in the gap, the space between the space at the end of the inhalation and at the end of the exhalation, where the natural flow of prana pauses for just a moment. And this space at the end of the inhalation and the end of the exhalation is an entrance point into the great heart, into the madhya, the center of consciousness, the space between one activity and the next. So as we've meditated on awareness in the last few classes, we have actually been meditating on the Shiva aspect of consciousness, which is generally described as the pure knower, the pure knowingness. And Shiva as the pure knower, as pure awareness, is even beyond the witness. The witness is one of the doorways into pure awareness, one of the more accessible doorways. And as we meditate on the witness, just as when we meditate on the great heart or when we meditate on Hamsa or when we meditate on the space between the breaths, we begin to be taken back through the layers of our thinking, the layers of our emotions, the layers of our physicality into that underlying consciousness. what we're taken into is the felt sense of pure being, which also has the qualities, of course, of intelligence and blissfulness. But Shiva Shakti, resting in itself, experiences itself as pure beingness and experiences bliss in that. And that experience is utterly beyond language. There really is no way to describe it. It's just a felt sense. But if you were to describe it, which, of course, many sages have tried to do, what you probably would say is, I am. Meaning, I exist, I feel my existence, and it feels good. And as many of you know, the I-ness in I am is connected with Shiva. The am-ness is connected with Shakti. So this idea, I am, meaning I exist and I know I exist, actually encodes the union of these two great principles of reality. Of course, for Shiva Shakti, the experience of being includes the awareness that all universes are contained within it. For us, not so much, but the basic feeling is the same. And the Sanskrit word for I am is aham, aham. You'll recognize hum. A is the first letter of the Sanskrit alphabet, and it's generally connected with Shiva. And one of the really interesting pieces of esoteric lore in the language mysticism of Tantra is that the letter A is actually inside every letter. In other words, and this has to do with Sanskrit pronunciation, for instance, you can't pronounce the letter K. In Sanskrit, the letter K is pronounced ka. So you can't pronounce it without the syllable a. You can't pronounce what in English we call L. In Sanskrit, it's la. You can't pronounce la without the syllable a, the letter a. So in Sanskrit, Shiva is in the form of a, is encoded in every letter and in every word. And within aham, within the mantra aham, countless linguistic forms arise. So, again, Sanskrit language mysticism is very much based on the arrangement of letters in the Sanskrit alphabet, and we are not going to go into that now because it's extremely esoteric, and most of us don't understand why we have to know about it. It's very interesting to linguists, and it has a lot of resonance. What we do need to understand, what's very helpful and useful to understand, is this idea that all language pours out of the heart, pours out of Shiva Shakti's silent speech, Shiva Shakti's rumination over the awareness I am, the awareness aham. So infinite creations, according to the sages, are born out of this one word, this one understanding. They vibrate endlessly, and they're expressed through sound forms, through vibratory resonance called matrikas. And we've discussed matrikas in the second class. They're the matrikas are, technically speaking, the energies within sound, within language. But they're also the forms that the primal vibratory resonance that arises out of the heart of consciousness takes in order to manifest physical and subtle reality. So, you know, in the tantric understanding of the universe, everything is considered to be vibration. You know, if you remember, there's a famous statement that's attributed to Albert Einstein, and apparently he really did say it. I found on the internet the source of it. It comes from an article he wrote. And he says, everything is energy. That's all there is to it. Match the frequency of the energy you want, and you cannot help but get that reality. This isn't philosophy. This is physics. So now, of course, no physicist would name this energy Shakti. much less conceive of a world orchestrated by a host of goddesses. But essentially, Einstein's statement is pointing out the same phenomenon as the Tantras, which is that this universe, both subtle and physical, is actually a tapestry of vibratory resonances, energies that manifest as different frequencies, some subtle, some very dense, some very physical. And because sound is the most immediately accessible form in which vibration becomes known to us, sound has an immensely transformative and immediately transformative effect on our psychic state. So whether it's the beauty of a Beethoven's Ninth Symphony or the grating sound of a leaf blower or the beats that ground hip-hop songs and connect their music to the rhythms of the streets, to the celestial music that we might hear in meditation, to the sound of the breath, to the music of the breath. Sound both expresses our state of consciousness at any given moment and is also, according to the tantrics, the main instrument for changing our state. So this is, of course, mantra lore 101, and when to the intrinsic power in sound you add the power of meaning, what you have is an incredibly powerful instrument, not only for interacting with other beings, but also for intervening in reality as we experience it. You know, in the tantras, mantras are considered to be instruments for transforming reality. And there are many, many different kinds of mantras, mantras which are intended to bless and mantras which are intended to harm. There's a complete science of using words, of using power, you know, empowered sound forms to change things. So the matrikas, which are the names of the groups of shaktis, the groups of energies that live within language, the matrikas are worshipped as a special group of goddesses who dance as the different types of letters, the vowels and consonants, to tune into their power and to receive their blessings. We can begin to recognize that the mantras can bind us. They really keep us stuck, as we know. They can trap us in hierarchical thinking and differentiation and in all the stories that create false knowledge. And we're, of course, seeing the negative power of matrika in our politics right now, certainly in the English-speaking world, but in other parts of the world. You know, as speech, including outright false speech, is being used to polarize us into tribes and factions and demonize whole groups of people and incite violence. And I've always been very interested in a particular teaching, which is also at the core of our understanding of mantra. And it's one of the central pieces of esoterica that's discussed in the commentaries to the Shiva Sutras. And it's this idea that these energies within words, the energies that make up the matrikas, that the matrika shaktis create, are of three types, each of which is presided over by a group of goddesses. And you can take this with a grain of salt if you like, but those of you who've done a lot of shakta practice, a lot of goddess practice, probably know exactly what they mean when they talk about these shaktis. So the three types of shaktis are called the gora shaktis. Gora means terrible. The Goratora Shaktis, the Goratora Shaktis are the very terrible Shaktis, and the Agora Shaktis, who are the non-terrible or benign Shaktis. So the word Gora, which means terrifying, doesn't mean just scary, it means terrifying. And it refers to the powers in language that create the feeling of duality, which any good tantrika regards as terrifying. You know, it's a true Indian yogi is scared by duality and does her best or his best to stay out of it. The Gora Shaktis are frightening because they're the powers behind the language that carves up reality into mine and yours, good and bad, inside and outside, all the polarities that keep us seeing the world through an ordinary mundane vision. And of course, these same powers, these same matrikas, are what allow us to navigate the world. You know, so they're very useful in the day-to-day and therefore really impossible to abandon. So one of the attitudes that Tantra inculcates in our use of language is to use it, you know, to create with it, but to remember that even when you're creating dualistic ideas with language, you always want to stay poised in the recognition that the duality is actually a fiction and that the reality is non-dual. So every time you say to yourself, I can do this but not that, or I'm a man or a woman or a gender nonconformist person, or even, you know, I'm tired, you're in the realm of the Gaudiya Shaktis. And then there are the Shaktis that rule the kind of language that doesn't just differentiate but also is overtly negative and destructive. These are the Gaudiya Tara Shaktis. And what's interesting to me is that even in the relatively ancient times out of which these texts came, people were very, very aware of the power of negative speech. So Gaudiya Tara Shaktis are the energies that come into play. They're not the words themselves. They're the energies that arise inside words, depending on the spin we give them and the spin with which they're received. So this is a language of anger, of self-blame, of hatred, of racism, of warmongering. The words that we use that make us feel inadequate or that we use to attack others. And, you know, to get really granular about it, of course, we're in this country, in the U.S. right now. We've just had a weekend of mass shootings, and at least one of the shootings seems to have been inspired by a series of ideas about white supremacy, which often appears as manifestos that are posted on the internet. So these shootings are directly related to the Gaudiya Tara Shaktis in hate speech. And I just want to say one more thing about this because it relates so powerfully to the power in language. I've been watching, one of my guilty pleasures the last few weeks has been watching a show on a TV show with Russell Crowe called The Loudest Voice, which is about Roger Ailes and Fox News. And at one point, Roger Ailes, who in this TV show, which is based on a book, is very much and very, very influential in Republican politics. He says to one of his subordinates, what you have to do is take one simple idea and repeat it over and over again. Doesn't matter if it's a lie. Because if you keep saying this one statement again and again, eventually it crowds out everything else said on this subject. And it becomes where people go when they think about it. And what he's talking about is negative mantra, you know, negative matrika, falsehoods that are believed and that become the source of action, the source of activity. So in a certain way, that statement is actually a very good example of how the power in language works. Now, to leave the subject of negative speech, hopefully for the rest of this time together and maybe for the rest of our lives if we can manage it. The Agoda Shaktis, Agoda means not terrible, which is a backhanded way of saying that the Agoda Shaktis govern the sound forms, the language, and the energy within positive language, within the language that protects us, that blesses us, and that ultimately liberates us. Another Sanskrit phrase for the language that expands consciousness is Shuddha Vidya. Shuddha meaning pure, Vidya meaning wisdom. Shuddha, language that contains Shuddha Vidya, ideas that contain Shuddha Vidya, is language that is not colored by Maya, that connects to the realms beyond Maya. And these, of course, are the words and phrases and ideas that heal our suffering and ultimately teach us the truth about ourselves. So Agoda Shaktis are operating when you look at another person and tell them, I love you. And you can feel that in the in the emotions that are that arise in you when somebody that you trust and think well of, and even someone that you may not necessarily trust, expresses affection and admiration for you in words. They trigger expanded feelings, good feelings. But, of course, what the tantricas are talking about when they talk about the Agora Shaktis is not simply the positive ideas that we hold, although they're all for, you know, positive self-talk and positive language. They're really talking about the great non-dual teachings. I am Shiva, my true nature is love. You are that. You know, in other words, these shaktis, these matrikas, are the empowerments that we use to take ourselves into higher states, into meditation. And, you know, we've all worked with these thought forms, every one of you. Everyone on the spiritual path has learned the secret of working with the energies of the mind, which very often involves witnessing thoughts, noticing the negative ones, substituting positive thoughts for negative thoughts, and working with inspired language such as mantras. This is kind of Yoga 101, but in my experience, it's not only the 101, it's also the 202 and the 303 and the 10010, because these truths remain with us at every level of practice. So the teachings of the Shiva Sutras, of course, are all made of Agora Shaktis, Shuddha Vidya, words, because they have this innate power to expand consciousness. But Shakta Upaya, the method of Shakti, which is what Book 2 of the Shiva Sutras is all about, is really the manual for empowering language and for understanding what it means to use empowered language to liberate yourself. Shakta Upaya is also known as Jnana Upaya, meaning that it's the method. Upaya means method or means of practice, means of sadhana. And Shakta Upaya or Jnana Upaya is the means of sadhana that makes use of the powers of the mind to expand the mind. So it's about understanding and practicing with your own mind, your own chitta, as we'll be seeing in a while. So those of you who've studied with me for a while probably know that most of my teaching actually comes from this collection of practices known as Shakta Upaya. I'm very much a Shakta Upaya practitioner. Core of Shakta Upaya is that it's not so much about the meaning of the words you use as about the energy inside those words and how that energy impacts and transforms your mind. And, of course, the big deal in this approach, the core truth in Shakta Upaya and in Tantra in general, is that we don't look at the mind in the ordinary way. You know, in yoga, in many, many of the yoga traditions, certainly in the Yoga Sutras, the mind is very much seen as an instrument. And in many of the Western spiritual traditions, meditative traditions, the mind is kind of demonized. You know, there's a statement in, I'm not sure where it comes from, but it's one of the famous aphorisms in Western mysticism. It says the mind is the slayer of the real. In other words, the mind is what gets in the way of our ability to see the truth. So what, and of course this is absolutely true, our thoughts are a major block to our experience of the pure self. But in Shakta Upaya, our understanding is much subtler than that, because in Shakta Upaya, what we recognize is that our mind is a series of pulsations rising and falling as waves in the ocean of Shakti. In other words, the mind is actually Shakti. The mind is the goddess. The mind is made of divine energy. And this is, I just had this experience that comes to me sometimes when I'm talking about the goddess. Sometimes when I talk about Shakti, when I talk about the goddess, I feel tears welling up, which some of you also may experience. And I always take that to be a sign that she's present, you know, that by talking about her in this way, we've brought her closer to us. So I'd like to welcome Shakti in the form of the mind and in the form of speech. So let's just for a moment pause, close our eyes, and look into our own mind. And I'm going to give you a particular protocol for doing this. With your eyes closed, just look into the field of what arises. In other words, you don't have to turn your attention around. Just look at what you see with your eyes closed. Almost as though you were staring into the screen of your mind. And just notice what you see. What I usually see when I do this, and it's what I'm seeing now, is a kind of field that's made up of moving particles of light. And at this moment, the light is kind of silvery sometimes, and for some of you, it's different colors. Many people close their eyes and see blue particles. But just notice how the field that you see with your eyes closed is dynamic. It's moving. It's pulsing. And some of its pulsations are thoughts, especially when I ask you to do something like this. Maybe the thought is, huh, or am I doing this right, or what's the big deal? But this practice is, it's actually one of the, it's one of the intermediate practices of some of the non-dual traditions. Because once we start to recognize that we can look into the field or the screen, you know, that's the best way to describe what you're seeing as this kind of screen in which there's constant movement, constant flow. And those moving particles and the thoughts that form inside that field of the mind are made of Shakti. So the teachings of Shakta Upaya constantly point us to the fact that the mind is a pulsation of the primordial Shakti, that the mind and its thoughts is actually a ray of Shakti emanating from the heart, emanating from the source. For me, and I think for some of you, this recognition that the mind itself is Shakti, it's one of the really liberating understandings of the Tantra. It's a core teaching in the Recognition Sutras, which some of you studied with me in 2018. It's really the heart of the teachings in this text. And what it tells us, what this teaching shows us, is that the movements in the mind, the vibratory, let's call it agitation, if you will, the lack of stillness in your mind field does not have to dissolve into silence for your meditation to be powerful and deep. If you can simply recognize that everything that arises in your mind field is a ray of Shakti emanating from the very heart of reality, it becomes relatively easy to just experience non-dual states in meditation and out of meditation, because you're not making an adversary of your own mind, nor are you becoming a slave of your mind. Because in this process of recognizing thoughts as Shakti, part of what you're doing is realizing that the Shakti in thought is actually has nothing to do with the content of thought. That is, there's Shakti in negative thoughts as well as in positive thoughts. And if you can see this, then it becomes relatively easy to transform the Gaura Shaktis and the Gauratara Shaktis, because they don't scare you. You're able to look through the negative content and see the energy at the heart of them. And once you can see your thoughts as energy, once you can see your mind as energy, then you actually can harness that energy and transform it. So this is the heart of the practices of Shakta Upaya. You start by recognizing the inherent divine energy in the mind, and then you work with it. You know, you might work with it by changing the contents of your thoughts. You also might work with it by using the creative power and imagination to inquire into the nature of your experience and even to change it. You know, one of the offshoots of Shakta Upaya understanding as it's been translated into the Western spiritual world is this new thought idea that's the basis of the law of attraction, which says that the human imagination is actually God. I mean, this is a statement that I've read in the writings of several New Thought teachers recently. The human imagination is God. And actually, that's true. You know, the human imagination is Shakti, which means that if you understand deeply the creative power of your own imagination, then you realize that it is a tremendous source of power, transformative power, within your own life, within your own mind, and potentially transformative power within the external world, which we're not going to talk about today, but which the Shakta Tantrikas were very aware of and pretty much okay with, especially when we're using that power to create positive realities, when we're doing genuine spiritual activism with our own imagination. So, deep breath in. And exhale. And this time, inhale. Really hearing the breath, make a noise with the breath, hearing hum as the breath flows in. Focusing on the pause. And then hearing the exhalation flow out as sigh. First three sutras of book two of the Shiva Sutras go like this. Sutra one, chittam mantraha, mind is mantra. Sutra two, prayatnaha sadakaha. Translation, ceaseless effort brings about the attainment of God consciousness. And sutra three, Vidya Sharira Satta Mantra Rahasyam. The secret of mantra is to be established in the knowledge of non-duality. So mind is mantra. Ceaseless effort brings about the attainment of God consciousness. We'll talk in a minute about what kind of effort they mean. And the secret of mantra is to be established in the knowledge of non-duality. So we're going to start with Sutra 1, which, just as the Sutra Chaitanyam Atma, actually contains the whole of Book 1 of the Shiva Sutras. Everything else in that book is kind of an offshoot of this primal teaching, the self as consciousness. In the same way, the heart of Shakta Upaya and the heart of Book 2 is in the Sur Sutra, your mind is mantra. So we want to look at what the word chitta means here and also what the word mantra means, because these are really, they really do contain the heart of some of the most powerful teachings in the Tantra, which are the teachings about mantra and deity. So chitta, as many of you know, is a Sanskrit word for what I like to call the mind stuff. You know, this, the insubstantial suchness, the energy of mind. So the citta is the field of the mind. It's what we were looking at a few minutes ago. It's a subtle energetic substance out of which thoughts are formed. I mean, thoughts are made of mind stuff, of the stuff of the citta. And of course, most of us don't really notice the citta as what it is, as the pure field of intelligent energy that it really is, because we're so caught up in the contents of the mind field. That is, you know, not just the thoughts and images and memories, but also the internalized sense perceptions, which is what makes up most of our experience. But all these thoughts and images, including our experience of perceptions, are all arising and being held in this screen, which is the citta. And the major truth about your citta is that it's made of the same stuff as the absolute consciousness, known as chit or chitti, the female form. You know, in Sanskrit, the word chit means absolute awareness. It means the same thing as Chaitanya. They have the same root. Chitta also has that same root. Chitta means an absolute consciousness in its phase as a limited and individual consciousness. And what the doctrine of recognition, which is another text that we study in Jivism, what it says, is that when the absolute consciousness manifests worlds, it descends from its transcendent state and becomes the human mind by contracting around thoughts and perceptions. So your mind is absolute consciousness filled with thoughts and perceptions. And of course, this brings us back to one of the, you know, primary yogic truths, which is that, as the second sutra of the Yoga Sutra says, if you can get the thought forms in the mind to dissolve, then you're going to be experiencing your mind as pure consciousness. So right now, if your eyes are not open, please open them and look around at the space you're in and recognize that what you're calling the room is actually appearing, filling your own internal space. So your experience at this moment, you're assuming yourself to be contained in this room that you're sitting in. In my case, it's my office, which is full of all kinds of books and papers and computer gear. It's kind of a busy space. So just be aware that in your perception at this moment, you are an individual form of Shiva Shakti, the Great Heart, manifesting a world. The world in this moment, in your case, is the world of the room you're in or wherever it is you are. But it is a world, and it appears to be outside your body for most of you. But in fact, it isn't really outside your body. It's really all being contained in one consciousness, which is become your mind in the process of manifesting duality. So in a certain sense, every one of us holds inside our citta a miniaturized form of what Shakti is holding when she holds the multiverse within her own being. Because we're limited, it's just a room. Because she's unlimited, it can be any galaxy or solar system or universes outside time and space. But it's the same consciousness that's holding the created experience of the universe. Why is this citta, which is creative consciousness in a limited form, why is it called mantra? Let's look at the word mantra. The tantric definition of mantra is contained in a very significant Sanskrit phrase, mananat trayate iti mantraha, which means mantra is that by contemplating which we are protected and saved. Mantra is that by contemplating which or by pondering which we are protected and saved. The word mananat means to ponder or to turn something over in the mind. The word traya means protect, means both protection and salvation. So what are we protected from? We're protected from duality. We're protected from samsara, the endless wandering of the mind and the suffering that comes with it. So essentially what this sutra is saying, or what the word mantra, what this definition of mantra is saying, is that if you hold a true mantra, and we'll talk in a minute about what that is, in your mind, and turn it over, chew it. I always like to say that practicing with a mantra is like chewing an orange. You know, you can't just bite into an orange. You have to take the skin off. You have to chew it. And as you chew it, the juice in the orange, the incredibly sweet juice, flows into your mouth and you taste its deliciousness. And mantra is like that also. We need to turn it over in the mind. We need to ponder it. And as you do, it will eventually give you the experience of the wordless consciousness. It'll melt. The mantra will melt into your mind, and then it will carry your mind into its own source, into its own essence, by dissolving all the other thoughts and impressions and ideas, not only in the superficial mind, but also in the subconscious. The thoughts that, you know, that the vasanas and samskaras, the conditioned ideas, the concepts, the beliefs that we're holding inside our subconscious, often without even knowing we have them, which are actually deforming our capacity for experiencing the truth about ourselves. The question that, you know, that one might ask is, how can a word land you in the wordless? And, of course, the answer is that a true mantra has nothing to do with our mundane understanding of a word. It's not, you know, an ordinary word is a signifier or a symbol. It points to something, like the English word rose points to the flower, but you can't smell the fragrance of a rose by saying the word. But this is not true of a mantra. A true mantra is literally a vortex of Shakti. And this recognition, this understanding, it's actually not just a vortex of Shakti. I'm skirting the truth. A mantra, a true mantra, the kind of mantra that this text is talking about, is God. It's not different than the deity. And this is such an esoteric, such a mystical idea that it's inexplicable to anybody who doesn't practice mantra. I'm going to try and explicate it. But I just want you to know that if you're still going tilt and going, you know, you expect me to believe 100 impossible things before breakfast, that it's not something that can really be intellectually understood, but it, boy, is it subject to experience. The mantras, the words that are defined as mantras, carry a direct depth charge of liberating energy, of protective energy, of genuine spiritual power that is intrinsic to them. It's locked into them. It's inside the syllables themselves. And by the way, that sutras of the Shiva Sutras are mantras, and they're totally filled with sacred energy, which is why so many of you are having powerful experiences when you repeat the Sanskrit to yourself. They work in you even if you don't fully understand the meaning, though understanding the meaning also makes a big difference. But when we talk about mantras, of course, we're usually talking about words that are used in meditation, words that are names of God, words we use to invoke deity. And in Tantra, they're very kind of strict when they talk about mantra. A mantra, you know, that even though we use a lot of words in spiritual practice that are not official mantras, that is, we chant hymns, we study teachings, both in the original language and in our own language. And these words, of course, have mantric power. But the mantras that we're talking about that directly liberate you are mantras like Hansa, Bija mantras like Hrim and Shrim and Klim, mantras like, of course, Om and Om Namah Shivaya and Om Dum Durgaya Namaha. These are mantras that connect you directly to some form of divine energy, to some form of deity, or to the absolute. So they're direct pathways from our ordinary state of mind into pure consciousness. So when you practice deeply with a mantra such that you really give it time to sink into your consciousness, the shakti in the mantra will literally transmit itself into the chitta. It will infuse itself into the chitta and transform your chitta so that it begins to, in some cases, give you back the mantra. One of my favorite, you know, miracle of the mantra stories from back in the day, back in the early days of my sadhana, was something that happened to a friend of mine who was doing the mantra Om Namah Shivaya, which she'd been given by her teacher. She was in a plane on a cross-country flight when all of a sudden, with no warning, the plane dropped 1,000 feet. Everyone in the cabin was screaming. Turned out something had happened to one of the engines and they had to make an emergency landing. So my friend was, of course, scared, terrified, and she suddenly, in the middle of her trying to manage her fear, her mantra rose up and began repeating itself very loud. And as she turned it and began to listen to the mantra, suddenly her body and the walls of the plane started to dissolve. And she began to have a direct experience that first everything became very soft and light, and then she got that even if the plane went down, even if it crashed and she died, that there would be no end because her body and herself were made of this incredibly subtle energy. So when the mind that has repeated a mantra for a long time with a lot of focus, as in the second sutra, prayatnaha sadakaha, the effort that you make to keep repeating the mantra, will eventually charge the chitta with the vibrations of the mantra. Of course, there are several factors that are important, and one of them is crucial, is that the mantra has to be empowered. And that means that the shakti in the mantra has to be awakened. Now, this is kind of paradoxical because in the core teachings of Tantra, mantras are said to arise from Kundalini herself. So mantras arise from the depths of the body, from that space between the Manipura chakra and the Muladhara chakra, where Kundalini plays. You know, in many of the yogic texts, Kundalini is said to reside in her sleeping form in the Muladhara chakra, from which she governs all the functions of the body, the breath, the heartbeat, everything else. And from that seat, the so-called sleeping Kundalini also manifests mantras. So it's kind of paradoxical that a mantra has to be awakened in order to actually function at its full capacity. But of course, the same thing is true of Kundalini. Kundalini, though omnipresent, though fully alive in the body, has to be activated in order for her to carry out her function of liberating your consciousness from delusion. So to awaken a mantra, to activate a mantra, means to activate the implicit shakti in a mantra. And according to all the tantric texts on mantra, what makes a mantra powerful is not the letters, which are a kind of jacket. It's the shakti, the intrinsic shakti in the mantra, not just, let's say, the subsidiary shakti, but really the primal Shakti that's at the heart of a mantra like Hamsa. And just as we can awaken Kundalini through our own practice, you know, through asana and bandhas and even mantras, in the same way we can awaken a mantra through our own practice. And if you read some of the tantric texts on mantra, you'll see that every mantra, when they tell you the meaning and the protocol for working with a mantra, they'll also tell you how many times you have to repeat it in order to activate it. Usually it's around 100,000 repetitions. But of course, the easiest and actually most powerful and effective way to empower a mantra is to receive it from your teacher or from a practitioner who empowers it for you. And I, by the way, I want to assure you that the mantras that we work with in this course and in all my courses do contain such a transmission. They're empowered for you. Now, there's several ways to create empowerment in a mantra that you're transmitting to someone else. One of them is to work with the mantra that comes from your own guru lineage, because then that mantra will be empowered by the lineage. The realization, the practice of all the teachers will fill it. But there's a less well-known way that a teacher can empower a mantra. When a teacher has access to the subtle field of higher energies, the higher tattvas, the higher principles, the areas of the subtle realm that are actually beyond Maya, that person, that teacher can, in meditation, enter that realm and, as it were, pluck a mantra or be given a mantra from that realm. And when you receive such a mantra in meditation, it is empowered for you, and it's also empowered for giving to someone else. So, and I'll just say something about the realm where mantras are said to have their source. It's a very subtle realm that's just a hair beneath the realms of Shiva Shakti, the realms of total non-duality. Because remember, mantras are forms, and a form is always slightly denser than the formless. So just as deities have forms, Shiva has a form. We know what he looks like because we've seen the statues and the paintings. Goddess has many forms. These forms are literally forms of the formless. They are condensed vibrational versions of the utterly limitless formless awareness. So the goddess Durga in form is a slightly condensed version of the primordial Shakti. So the mantras come from this same very exalted level of consciousness, the first evolution of form, far above manifestation and far above Maya. So, and of course, every mystical tradition talks about these realms. They're sometimes called, in the Western tradition, the angelic realms or the archangelic realms, very similar. So empowerment is the first requisite for a mantra being truly effective. The second factor is your intention. In other words, if you're repeating a mantra with the intention to transform your consciousness, it will be much more powerful than if you're just saying it casually or just experimenting with it, trying it out. The third crucial factor is your understanding about what the mantra is. And this is really the radical take that the tantrikas give us for how mantra works. We've actually already said this. We've already spoken about this. Sutra 3 says that the heart of the mantra is the radiance of pure consciousness. So the secret of the mantra is the non-dual presence that lives within it. The secret of the mantra is Shiva Shakti. So as we said earlier, the letters themselves are kind of a vessel. And the mantra is the divine within it, which is God in sound form. And this understanding about mantra is very connected to the tantric understanding about the forms of deities. these anthropomorphic forms of condensed consciousness like Ganesha and Lakshmi and Durga and the form of Shiva. You know, these deity forms are, you know, part, you know, the, I think the fact of these deity forms, this is a postmodern interpretation of it, but I would say that the fact of these deity forms is related to the fact that these traditions all come out of the religious practices of the Hindus and the Tantric Buddhists, especially with Tibetan Buddhism, you know, who are very comfortable with the idea of deities, of, you know, anthropomorphic forms. And in Tantric traditions, a form of a deity is often used as a kind of bridge between your ordinary state of consciousness and the ultimate truth of who you are. So a deity can be kind of an invisible friend. And I'm kind of serious about that. It's been one of the very beautiful experiences that I've had as a result of doing as much deity practice as I do, that when you have a relationship with a personal deity in form, it really helps you focus petitionary prayer, cries for help, but it also helps you become more and more intimate with what divine energy feels like. You know, there's something about being able to focus on a visual form or a mantric form that brings all the energies of the divine together in a kind of a compact way, so that you can have a relationship with it. You know, and I would say that, you know, what the sages of the Hindu tradition often say is that because we have bodies, it's very helpful to us to practice with God in a body, even a very subtle body, because, of course, deity forms are not material. They're made of light. They're made of energy. But they can be visualized and cultivated, and people who really, really do hardcore deity practice can often, as it were, invoke a deity with so much particularity and specificity that the deity actually appears before them, sometimes hovering in the air, sometimes seated before them. Sometimes, of course, in dreams. I think many of you have had dreams in which deities have appeared. But the culmination of tantric deity practice always is to identify yourself with the deity, to imagine the deity within your own body. And that people, you know, tantric practitioners do this from the very get-go, from the very beginning. So you imagine your hands the deity's hands, your eyes are the deity's eyes. You actively spiritualize or sacralize your body by identifying it with a goddess or with a masculine deity. And over time, and again, some of you have done this kind of practice, I certainly have, you begin to feel your body infused with sacred energy, and you can start to recognize how sacred your physical body actually is when you really understand how to look at it. Meaning that Jesus was not kidding when he said you are as gods. Tantric deity practice intends you to recognize this. So when you're cultivating a relationship with deity, remember you always do it by meditating with one or two of the three main deity forms. The iconographic form of the deity, like the image of Sarasvati with her stringed instrument, the yantra or the mandala, the geometric a representation of the deity, which literally represents the lines of energy that come together to create the energy form called goddess or Shiva. But whatever form you're using, you always practice with a mantra. Because remember, vibration is the source of all manifestation. So the vibratory resonance, the mantra associated with a particular deity, is not a symbol of the deity. It is the deity itself. It is the deity itself. And that's where all the mystical traditions of India and Tibet agree about mantra. Tukaram Maharaj, who is one of the great saints of Western India from the 16th century was when he lived, wrote in one of his poems, when you repeat God's name, you touch God with your tongue. When you listen to God's name, you take God in with your ears. So the more deeply you understand this, the more deeply the mantra will infuse your citta, and the greater the chance is of your citta revealing itself as mantra. So when you repeat the mantra soham, it makes a huge difference if you are repeating it not mechanically, but with the understanding that this mantra is an articulatable form of cultivating your own sacred self. When you practice with the seed syllables, one of the mantras that I like and that many of you like, Om Aim Hrim Klim Chamundaye Viche, makes a huge difference if you feel that you're holding on your tongue the sound form of the goddess and filling yourself with her powers of inspiration, creativity, divine pleasure. So in Tantra, taking a mantra deeply into your citta with the awareness of what it really is what guarantees that the grace within the mantra will fully infuse your mind substance. And tantric mantra practice is very, very multi-leveled. So, in other words, the same mantra can both connect you to the self, can connect you to the pure source of all, can transform your mind into a field that is constantly giving you the experience of your own sacredness and the sacredness of the world. It can also be of specific benefit to you in worldly life. And no tantrika worthy of the name will disdain the worldly benefits of mantra. You know, as you probably remember, tantra advertises itself as the path that includes both liberation and worldly benefit. And the great mantras are really the secret of integrating your spiritual intentions and also your intentions to have a good life, to have a life of abundance and joy. I know when I first began meditating with a Lalita mantra after many, many years of practicing with a Shiva mantra, I noticed that the Lalita mantra had a very, very different feeling tone to it, feeling sense to it. And after I practiced it for a few months, I started to notice that when I said the mantra, my body would fill with a kind of rosy red light and a deep sense of vibrancy. And I began to notice that my health was better, that I had much more vitality, that I was looking better, that there was a rasa, a juiciness in my being that was kind of unique, that was not really the same rasa that I was experiencing with the Shiva mantra, which was much more quiet, much more still, much more obviously peaceful. And through that mantra, that as I practiced with that mantra, it began to become the lens, really, literally like a lens, which is something that many of the texts of the songs of tantric saints sing. I would come out of meditation and look at the room I was in and the landscape of the valley I live in, and it would be utterly clear that all of this was goddess, that the practice with the mantra was changing my vision. And I want to say that when I didn't practice the mantra so rigorously, the power of that vision, the vision that it gave me, became less. And it would be very apparent, to when I would come out of meditation and, for instance, open the computer and read the New York Times, how different the quality of my citta was when I was immersing it in mantra and when I was immersing it in, in the articles by the Times opinion writers. And because I like to read the newspaper, I would have this experience daily of the contrast between the luscious, non-dual, sacred feeling state of my mind and body infused with mantra and the busy, opinionated, anxious state of my citta when I infused it with the contents of the Times editorial page. And I know you know what I'm talking about because we all have our versions of this. So you are what you're holding in your mind. Your citta is not just a screen. Your chitta is an energy throbbing with creative consciousness. It can become anything, and you have the power to, let's say, allow and invite the liberating shaktis, the agora shaktis, the shaktis within mantra, to fill you up and infuse you, purifying your mind, purifying your body, and eventually showing you yourself. That is, the mantra itself will show you not only what it really is, but what you really are. Chittam mantraha, the mind is mantra. So Sutra 2, Prayatnaha Sadakaha, really gives us the bottom line clue as to how we get to experience the sacred mind, how we get to realize the mind is mantra. The mind is mantra, chitta mantra, really means mind is goddess, mind is shakti, mind is the creative power of the universe. No kidding, it really is. As Kshema Raja says in his commentary on this sutra, the mind of the devotee intent on intensive awareness of the deity inherent in the mantra acquires identity with that deity and thus becomes the mantra itself. It is this mind that is mantra, not the mere agglomeration of various letters. So that's a very far out statement. And my guru, in his commentary on this mantra, which is in a book of his called Nothing Exists That Is Not Shiva, says the same thing in his own language. So I'm going to read you what he has to say about it. Mantra is the undifferentiated, integral awareness of the nature of the divine. Mantra is the undifferentiated, integral awareness of the nature of the divine. Undifferentiated means that there is no sense of separation from the mantra or from the self. And integral means that you've actually integrated the vibrations of the mantra with your own mind. Mantra should not be regarded as separate from God. Being one with God, it is full of bliss. It arises by itself. In other words, a true mantra is not imposed. Like Hamsa, which is a true mantra, Hamsa Soham, it arises by itself. It comes as the sound of the breath. It's encoded in the body as the sound of the breath. It is the vibration of mantra that springs forth as a universe. The whole cosmos throbs in the mind. The whole cosmos throbs in the mind. Just think about this. Which is itself mantra. The person who attains oneness with mantra by remaining in unity consciousness annihilates the world of dualities. Now this is the advanced course in mantra. For the intermediate practitioners and the beginning practitioners, it's important to start by, first of all, understanding the meaning of the mantra, and secondly, learning to identify yourself with the mantra. And practically speaking, this doesn't mean that you keep going, you keep saying, mantra is God, mantra is myself, all the time you're repeating it. It means that you very firmly set the intention at the beginning of your practice. I'm going to be practicing with the mantra. And this mantra, this sacred word or series of words, is itself the divine. It is myself, my highest self. It is the goal of my practice. By repeating this mantra, I'm taking this truth into myself with every breath. And then here's the thing he said that blew my mind. It is important to see that we are not primarily concerned with the component syllables of a mantra or its deity in the usual sense. Here, the word mantra refers to the mind, particularly to the throbbing movement of the mind by which a yogi meditates. I'll say this again. Here the word mantra refers to the mind, particularly to the throbbing movement of the mind by which a yogi meditates. So we're going to meditate for a few minutes with the mantra Hamsa. But before we do, I'd like to ask you to close your eyes . Let your attention flow to the breath. And turn your attention inward, whether inward towards the heart or inward towards the center of the head. It really doesn't matter. What you want to do is actually practice looking inward at your own mind. And see if you can notice that the field of your mind actually is throbbing. It pulsates. And the pulsation in the mind, although it often arises and subsides in rhythm with the heartbeat, it's actually subtler than the heartbeat. Especially for someone who's done a lot of mantra practice and cleaned out some of the more catchy thought forms in the mind. It becomes possible in meditation to really tune into this subtle, wordless pulsation that is always throbbing in your inner consciousness, which is the footprint or the breadcrumb trail of the Shakti. Out of that vibration, out of that pulsation, thoughts arise. But at the beginning and the end of the thought, there is just this throbbing, this pulsation, this spanda. Which is the inner mantra that is constantly repeating itself in your citta. So I'm going to ask you to investigate that a little bit next week. And right now, we're going to practice with Hamsa mantra. And we're going to practice with this recognition, which is from a tantric text called the Srikanta Samhita. It's said negatively, but listen to it in its negative form and convert it to its positive meaning. If the practitioner of the mantra is different than the mantra, then his mantra will not be successful. Knowledge of the oneness between you, the mantra, and the divine eye consciousness is the root of all this. So, this is the heart of tantric practice and certainly the heart of mantra practice. Just cultivate the understanding that you are already the self. You're already the goal of your practice. And the mantra is the expression of that. Let your attention flow to the breath. Hearing, if this is comfortable for you, the breath flowing in with hum, and out with sa. Sensing how the breath and the mantra are drawn in by the action of the diaphragm. And how at the end of the inhalation, the syllable hum and the inhalation merges in the heart space. And how at the end of the exhalation, syllable sa merges in the space outside. Recognize that the mantra, which is filled with the energy of my lineage, my practice, and the lineage and practice of so many thousands of practitioners. And recognize that this mantra is the voice of your own self, reminding you, I am that. I am the Supreme I Consciousness. I am Shiva Shakti. Everything in this universe arises from my own heart, from my own being. So allow yourself to breathe with Hamsa. Perhaps you would like to sense the natural opening into the heart at the end of the inhalation. Letting yourself pause for a second there. Perhaps also allowing the inhalation to flow through the back so that the pause also connects you to the space beyond the body. But it's enough just to feel your identity with the mantra. Allowing yourself to pause for a second at the end of the inhalation and at the end of the exhalation. To feel the wordless space, the madhya, the doorway to the heart. And to feel how every breath is sounding this profound declaration, I am that. Just let yourself be in Hamsa, the breath, and the space between. you may want to sit for a few minutes after the call ends to meditate, because of course there's a lot deeper we can go as we sit longer. In the meantime, thank you. So what I wanted to say before I lost my voice is that we're going to have another Q&A before the course is over, and I'll discuss with Deb what works for her, and we'll send you an email in the next day or so telling you what time we'll be having it. And the homework will be coming tomorrow along with the audio. So have a great evening and a great week, and we'll see you next week and between then on the Q&A. Much love. Namaste.
मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचेतानि नाहि न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमेन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातुर्न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मेऽन्नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासंगतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मे चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा अहम् भोजनम् नैव भोज्यम् न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहम् शिवोऽहम् चिदानन्दरूपा अहम् निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेन मे अहम् भोजनम् नैव भोज्यम् न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहम् शिवोऽहम् चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहम् शिवोऽहम् अहम् निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानम् शिवोऽहम् शिवोऽहम् चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहम् शिवोऽहम् चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहम् शिवोऽहम् चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहम् शिवोऽहम् शिवोऽहम्।